there. My name is Jean Tiberio, and I'm a nutritionist and a wellness coach. Welcome to Healing Outside the Box. Today is episode 107, and I'm calling it Trends in Preventing and Controlling Obesity. What works, what doesn't. Now, before I begin, I want to let you know that what you'll be getting today is mostly my opinion on just about everything. Now, I do consult with my imaginary friend. Let's call her Minnie Jean, and she agrees with me on, again, almost everything. So we're good there. Now, I came across this University of Virginia article that was called Super Centers May Be Supersizing Americans. Now, here is the problem with trying to pinpoint one source of the problem. There are actually many causes contributing to the obesity rates, and really no one can say with any certainty if one particular cause is more important than the rest. But they take a crack at it in this article, which is worth reviewing. In this particular article, this guy named Ruhm, spelled R-U-H-M, states that, this is a quote, "There's been a very rapid rise in obesity in the last 3 decades, but we don't fully understand what the causes are. Here we are attempting to do a more integrated study that looked at a larger variety of potential causes." So by that quote, I'm assuming that he looked at a number of factors and not just the presence of superstores. By the way, the CDC now reports that about 1/3 of adult Americans are obese, up from 13% in 1960. The guys and, well, maybe the gals, in this particular study looked at 27 different factors that might possibly be related to the rise in obesity. I'm not sure that their conclusions were much more conclusive than any other study on the subject. And from subject, we get the word subjective, which is hard to avoid when you go into a massive study like this and have some idea what the endpoints or results will be. Now, we all know that there are economic factors involved in the percentage of people in any given region that are overweight. But what economic factors? There's a number of overlapping factors that need to be pulled apart, and we're not sure how to do this. One factor that stood out in this study was the number of restaurants, in particular fast food restaurants, per capita in any one location. That's no surprise. What did surprise these researchers was that another factor that stuck out was the number of... By that, they are talking about the membership grocery stores, such as BJ's or other wholesale stores. They sell their food in large bulk, and they are presumed to be less expensive than the average retail superstore. They're also called grocery clubs. I'm sure you have one in your area. The issue here is that these stores sell large quantities of impulsive purchases. I went to BJ's on several occasions, and I found that there were healthy food. It was available. Chips, cookies, ice cream, soda, those types of food were sold in huge quantities, and it did seem like they were a good deal. But I took another example, which for me was paper towels. They came in 16 rolls in one package. Now, when you look at 16 rolls and look at the price, what immediately comes to mind is, does that sound like a good price for all those rolls? And we're just guessing at the answer. So for myself, I consider math to be a bit of a sport. So I decided I was going to divide the total cost by 16. And it turns out for a single roll, it was actually more expensive than Walgreens. And I'm also guessing that we're not all going to do the math with every single item. And these stores count on that. And here's how I feel about money in this regard. The economic as well as the psychological cost of having obesity and diabetes makes these types of stores not such a great deal at all. The situation with lots of fast food restaurants nearby is more complicated. It's a free country and they can park themselves wherever they like. But in general, it is almost always more expensive for any consumer to eat out versus to cook in. So perhaps running out to the nearby restaurant is seen by some consumers as a time-saving option, not necessarily a money-saving option. It seems to me that if we're saving all this time, we should have a lot of time on our hands. But I'm guessing that you don't feel that way. And what's the difference in time? I used to say to people, you've got nothing but time, and that would usually annoy them. It's a matter of what any of us choose to do with our time, which again, is free in a free country. This guy, Rum, says that it might be unrealistic to expect to cut down on restaurants in low-income areas of this country, and perhaps less realistic to eliminate the wholesale food clubs. I agree with that. He goes on to suggest that we might want to consider giving incentives for people to produce and choose healthy food. Amen to that. In other words, what he's suggesting is that we could subsidize local organic farmers instead of food corporations. Now, that may seem like it will never happen, but as the saying goes, never say never. It seems to be common knowledge around the water cooler these days that it will cost too much to feed our school children and our adults a healthy and organic diet. Well, let's talk about the cost of not doing that. Shall we? I think we shall. It's estimated that 1/3 of U.S. adults are obese, as we've mentioned. Chronic conditions that may be caused by obesity include, hold on to your hats, heart disease, there's billions of taxpayer dollars spent there, strokes, type 2 diabetes, which will cost a fortune because now up to 50 million Americans are diabetic or pre-diabetic. There's also many cancers that can be caused by obesity. Now, pretty much we just touched upon the leading causes of preventable death. I know what you'll be saying. Well, Gene, death isn't preventable. It's like taxes that way. You have a point. Let's talk about cost per person. Medical costs per person for people who are obese is in the $1,500 to $2,000 per person per year range, and that's a conservative estimate. Once a person gets cancer or heart disease, or the kidneys start to go because of diabetes, those numbers go way up on a per-person basis. Easily for someone on dialysis, it's over $1 million per person. Certain populations are hit harder than others when it comes to obesity. Blacks have the highest age-adjusted rates of obesity, and Asians have the lowest. And again, that's in terms of age-adjusted rates of obesity. Now, if you compare African Americans with Mexican Americans, in terms of just the men, the results go against what you might expect. Those men with higher incomes are more likely to be obese than those with low incomes. With women, the trends tend to be more related to education. Those with college degrees are less likely to be obese compared to those who have less education. And by no means am I suggesting that this is a simple issue. There's many other complicated factors that weave in and out of this. Now, in terms of nutrition education and awareness about healthy eating, let's talk about what works and what doesn't work. And I may be doing another podcast episode on this in the near future. Now, once again, you're getting my opinion, and other opinions may vary and probably will. Now, right off the bat, I can tell you that your local dietitian giving you that instruction pamphlet with all the different colorful food groups does not seem to work. And I can tell you that because I was one of those dietitians. I know this isn't common knowledge, but dietitians are the least respected professionals in the hospital. As I've mentioned in previous podcast episodes, dietitians are the Rodney Dangerfields of the hospital. If you don't believe me, I'll give you an example. One day I was sitting on a chair next to my patient's bed. I was instructing her on a diabetic diet for diabetes and weight loss. This was one of those mandatory pamphlets that we gave to all diabetics, and it had lists of different groups of foods. And at the top, there was a blank for how many grams of protein, how many grams of carbohydrate, and how many grams of fat that they would be allowed to eat each day. And then below, as I've mentioned, there were the different food groups. Predictably, there was the protein separated between lean protein, chicken and fish, and high-fat protein, such as steak and bacon. Then you had the free vegetables, meaning you could have as many as you want, and there usually was a pretty pitcher of a broccoli. Then you have the starchy vegetables, which were limited because this was a diabetic diet, which, by the way, was put together with a great deal of fanfare by the American Dietetic Association. So the starchy vegetables and the starches were limited and generally referred to as exchanges or serving sizes. And then there was the fat group, the oils and the so-called healthy fats and the saturated fats. And of course, there were pretty pictures to go along with all the lists on this particular pamphlet. This pamphlet instruction does not work on so many levels, not the least of which is because people simply don't eat in food group exchanges. It also does not allow for any cheating, and I believe that the word cheating should never be used because it implies guilt and punishment. You should only be talking about the word cheating if you're discussing your neighbor's husband and then have a go at it. Now, this type of diet plan allows little free will and choice from the patient's point of view, and the all-important psychological factors that determine what we eat and how much we eat are not even mentioned. Oh, but back to my story about getting no respect. So I was in the hospital talking to this patient about her food preferences and her diet history when her doctor walked in. He passed by me in front of me, nearly tripping over my feet, and quickly closed the curtain across the front of my body without ever establishing eye contact with me. I stood there for a while, pretty much dumbfounded that I was staring into a curtain. Apparently, he assumed that I was part of the furniture and not worthy of a mere excuse me, as if any verbal communication with me would have wasted his breath. It's hard to imagine that the patient that I was talking to had any respect for me after that. My salary at the time was $9 per hour, with a completed master's degree, so that speaks for itself. We were so low on the importance totem pole that insurance companies would not pay for any kind of nutrition education in the hospital, even if the dietitian is a registered dietitian and the patient is morbidly obese with uncontrolled diabetes. And here's the irony. The surgeon that was seeing her would have gotten paid about $30,000 or more to amputate her toes due to uncontrolled diabetes. Need I say more? The next diet plan that I don't think works that well is the paleo diet or similar diets, which are high protein, high fat, and very low carbohydrate. This is the way our ancestors ate. They were the great hunter-gatherers. First of all, these hunter-gatherers did as much gathering as they did hunting. And the actual evidence says that they apparently gathered quite a bit of plants, nuts, fruits, and starchy vegetables. Now, I think the modern-day paleo diet works short-term, certainly, because it cuts out sweetened cereals, donuts, ice cream, chips, soda, etc. But many people that are critical of this suggest that there are almost no studies with a control group to examine whether or not this diet works. And as one nutritionist in the field has said, wild kangaroos and alligators would have been better choices than today's boneless, skinless chicken breasts. People certainly lose weight on the paleo diet, but because they've cut out the junk food and are eating less calories overall. And this is one of those deals where going on a diet assumes that you're coming off the diet. Another thing about paleo is that it forbids beans and other foods that we call legumes. I like saying that word. Legume. It's always a good idea to add those to your diet. They provide great soluble fiber and help lower cholesterol. Now, another option that most certainly works short-term, but not long-term, is some type of weight loss surgery. Most commonly, this is called gastric bypass surgery, which I discussed in the previous podcast episode. I believe it was 106. I'll give you a link in the show notes. Another program I looked at was worksite wellness programs. In theory, this should be very effective, but I didn't find good evidence that it works long term. I think the primary reason here that it is not as helpful as like Weight Watchers is that the employee probably doesn't feel like they have full choice with their participation. In other words, the employee may feel pressured to join a program like that, and success should never be tied in with work performance in any way. Okay, so let's now talk about the things that I feel do work or may work. Number one, a variety of community efforts such as early childhood care or daycare nutrition programs. Another community effort is farmers markets. That's a really good idea. Another community program is nutrition and calorie information at local restaurants, also schools and hospitals. There's also strategies and programs to increase physical activity in the community. And this can include social media, local television programs, etc. And my favorite topic, a vegetable garden in every school. Number two, speaking of schools, there should be a high priority on an effort to teach children how to grow their own food, cook their own food, and how important it is to maintaining normal weight and a healthy lifestyle throughout life. This is the one I will do a future podcast episode on. Number three, as for weight programs that I think work, I generally recommend Weight Watchers or similar group support programs, which seem to work not only because the dietary information is good and easier to follow, but also because the social support and positive reinforcement is part of that big picture. Now, as for what types of foods, the Mediterranean diet has been adhered to for thousands of years, not 30 days, and it includes plenty of nuts, seeds, produce, lean fish, and good vegetable oils. And the only thing that will work is something that can be sustained for a long period of time. The Blue Zone people who live up to 100 years and are healthy for most of that time is proof of that. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is making improvements in the food stamp program. I think this is another way we can have a positive influence on low-income people, especially their children. There are now incentive programs that are being built into the food stamp program. And these incentive programs are put forward by, do I need to say this? The Democrats, that are looking to allow people more buying power and more choice when it comes to produce and organic foods. I believe all the farmers markets in Massachusetts take food stamps, and many local grocers that sell organic grains and organic prepared food are now taking food stamps as well, at least in Massachusetts. This is indeed the trend, and hopefully it will continue. Now, as I mentioned, I'm putting together an episode that just focuses on what we can do within our school system that will not only be inexpensive, but hopefully will change the way our children see food in the world, in what they can do to eat healthier, whether they are on a tight budget or not. And as I like to say, I would love to build a big wall, that is a big wall of hugs around the world. That's all I have for you today. Be well and stay tuned next week for another episode of Healing Outside the Box.